The 2024 presidential campaign features two candidates who are very well known to Americans. And yet, there's complexity at every turn. Criminal trials for one of those candidates. Young voters who are angry. The Campaign Moment podcast from The Washington Post gives you what matters. I'm Aaron Blake, and I'm covering my 10th election cycle. My colleagues and I have insights that you won't find anywhere else. So follow The Campaign Moment right now, wherever you're listening.
AT&T connects an ode to podcasts. Connect the alarm. Change the podcast you stream. Connect the snooze. 10 more minutes to dream. Connect the shower. Lather up with the news. Sports talk, comedians, or movie reviews. Connect with that 3-hour philosophy show. Change the drive into work in traffic so slow. Connect the dishes to voices that glow. Thank you to the geniuses of spoken audio. Connect the stories. Change your perspective. Connecting changes everything. AT&T.
This is your moment. Your time to shine. Your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
It's Thursday, May 6th. I'm Oscar Ramirez in Los Angeles, and this is The Daily Dive. Facebook's oversight board has ruled that former President Trump will remain banned for now. The board ruled that Facebook was justified in banning Trump, but took issue with the indefinite suspension, calling it vague and uncertain. They gave Facebook 6 months to decide if the ban is permanent and also to fully explain their decision. Heather Kelly, technology reporter at The Washington Post, joins us for why Trump's ban continues. Next, drug makers and labs are already working on the next generation of COVID vaccines, and they could come in the form of a pill or nasal spray. Researchers also hope to eventually work on a universal vaccine to provide protection against all types of coronaviruses. Gregory Zuckerman, special writer at The Wall Street Journal, joins us for the next generation of COVID-19 vaccines. Finally, the tools to treat patients in the medical field have changed and improved over time, but the tools in psychiatry are still largely the same ones used 100 years ago. But with the rise of big data, the information captured on our smartphones, and speech and facial recognition technologies can provide more insights for mental health professionals. Dr. Daniel Barron, author of Reading Our Minds, The Rise of Big Data Psychiatry, joins us for why it's time to use this data to make psychiatry more precise and effective. It's news without the noise. Let's dive in.
And the second part is a series of policy recommendations. And Facebook is considering its suggestion that it go back to the drawing board and come up with a different punishment as a policy recommendation. And that means it actually doesn't have to abide by it, but it is going to have a public reply sometime in the next 30 days.
Joining us now is Heather Kelly, technology reporter at The Washington Post. Thanks for joining us, Heather.
Thanks for having me.
The Facebook oversight board that was going to rule on whether they were going to uphold the ban on President Trump's Facebook page has ruled to uphold that ban, at least for now. They also said that Facebook needs to do a review of their practices there, basically saying, you know, that they couldn't just rule that he had to have an indefinite suspension. They need to rule on if it would be permanent or not, or if they would reinstate him and why. So, Heather, tell us a little bit about what the Facebook Oversight Board said.
So you pegged it right there. They came back with this sort of split decision. The way the board is set up, and again, it is created and funded by Facebook. The people on it are chosen by Facebook, but it is considered this sort of separate entity. And the way it's set up is that they have two parts to every decision. The first is binding, not legally, but like, I don't know, a gentleman's agreement with Facebook that Facebook will do whatever the first part is. And that is if it's going to overrule its ban or uphold it. And in this case, it did uphold the ban of Trump. And the second part is a series of policy recommendations. And Facebook is considering its suggestion that it go back to the drawing board and come up with a different punishment as a policy recommendation. And that means it actually doesn't have to abide by it, but it is going to have a public reply sometime in the next 30 days.
The president did respond and say that free speech has been taken away from the president of the United States. But, you know, as we remember, this all goes back to the riots on the Capitol from January 6th and a lot of the statements that he was posting on his social media. So what were the specific things that they were ruling on, the specific posts?
They did look at the two posts he made on or around January 6th. They also did look back at past posts, but those weren't taken as much into consideration. It was really about the final decision and what it included. And in those posts, he had expressed support for the people at the Capitol. Now, in a letter to the board, kind of written on his behalf to defend him, it said that any Trump supporters that were there that day were peaceful and nonviolent and that there were outside agitators involved. So that's sort of his defense for the post that day and that they were misconstrued.
We're months away from the actual day that they banned him now. And why did this take so long?
So when the board was created, it's really interesting. They've given it this whole fake legal structure, including all the bureaucracy and rules that come with that.
They kept referring it to as like the Supreme Court of Facebook decisions or whatever.
Exactly. Except, again, zero legal standing. It's just humans getting together to discuss things. So what happens is it's all written in these bylaws, which explains how the board is going to work. They were agreed upon between the board and Facebook. And Facebook or individuals can recommend cases to the board. It's heard fewer than 10 at this point, so it's not exactly reviewing every major decision. And then it has 90 days to go over that. So this was referred to them probably at the end of January. And so they had 3 months. They made a panel of five people. Five of the 20 board members were specifically focused on this one case. And then they had a slight extension at the end, and they take it to the whole board, and then the whole board discusses it and tries to agree on it as a majority.
Now, President Trump on Tuesday, before this decision came through, launched his own social media blog-type website from the desk of Donald J. Trump. And in it, it just looks like a very parsed down Twitter, let's say. It's just a bunch of his musings, statements, things like that going back a couple months. But on that site, there's a feature where users can share those posts to Facebook, Twitter, things like that. Has Facebook or Twitter even said anything with regards to this? Because he's obviously banned still, but his statements are going to be starting to flood those sites, I'm assuming.
Yeah, so until now, he's been able to release press releases, basically. And then those have been covered by news outlets or sent out in emails. There wasn't anything too much stopping them from appearing on social media. People could copy and paste them or share them themselves. What Twitter and Facebook, but Twitter especially, had was this rule that there was no way to try and wiggle around your ban by using somebody else's account. And what remains to be seen is if it will consider this an attempt to get around the ban. Now, as you mentioned, it's kind of a social media site. At this point, I would compare it more to like an old WordPress blog. It's
right,
a simple post. There's a heart on there, but you can't really tell what happens if you click the heart. It's not like there's a count for them. But there is a share button for Facebook and Twitter. I looked up one of his more recent posts. It had about 18 shares on Facebook right after it went up. So I think a lot depends on how much traction they get, if it takes off, if people are paying attention. And only then will it really be worth their time to cause a bit of a fuss over them.
Heather Kelly, technology reporter at The Washington Post. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
The 2024 presidential campaign features two candidates who are very well known to Americans. And yet, there's complexity at every turn. Criminal trials for one of those candidates. Young voters who are angry. The Campaign Moment podcast from The Washington Post gives you what matters. I'm Aaron Blake, and I'm covering my 10th election cycle. My colleagues and I have insights that you won't find anywhere else. So follow The Campaign Moment right now, wherever you're listening.
AI might be the most important new computer technology ever. It's storming every industry, and literally billions of dollars are being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs a lot of speed and processing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? It's time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud. Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. OCI has 4 to 8 times the bandwidth of other clouds, offers one consistent price instead of variable regional pricing, and of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. So now you can train your AI models at twice the speed and less than half the cost of other clouds. If you want to do more and spend less like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic, take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/strategic. That's oracle.com/strategic. oracle.com/strategic.
This is it. Your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cb for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
They're saying, hey, maybe we'll take a J&J to start with and then bring in the Moderna one, or maybe vice versa, or maybe like BioNTech and then the switch to the Moderna one. So maybe there's some combination that we can improve on.
Joining us now is Gregory Zuckerman, special writer at The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for joining us, Gregory.
Oh, great to be here.
It's nice to think that we're so far along in the pandemic and we have these vaccines and some effective treatments that we can start thinking about the next generation of COVID vaccines. Drug makers, government labs, they're working to develop easier to take doses, easier to transport doses as well. And we're looking, other shots, most likely, yes, but we're also looking at pills and maybe even nasal sprays. So, Gregory, tell us a little bit more about what we're seeing for these next generation of COVID vaccines.
So the thing to remember is the ones that are out there right now are quite effective, but there are still ways to improve. As many of us know, the existing vaccines need to be kept, or at least some of them, the mRNA ones, like the Pfizer and Moderna ones, need to be kept at cold temperatures, transported at cold temperatures. And that's difficult, not just in the United States, but especially in other kinds of countries where they don't have the cold chain technology that we do. So that's one of the areas of emphasis for some of these other kind of companies. And it's not just companies, it's also scientists, as you mentioned, in government, but also academia as well, trying to create vaccines that don't need to be kept at the same cold temperatures.
There's 277 vaccines currently in development globally. 93 of those have entered human trials already. So we're still expecting to see a lot more in the form of varieties of vaccines coming out. And as I mentioned, those oral pills and nasal sprays could be coming up next, which is exciting in a way where people don't have to take the shot. If they're hesitant about those things, they have other options now.
Yeah, that's exactly right. There are all kinds of reasons why people are hesitant to take the vaccine. Some of them are more legitimate or based in science than others, but there is one issue that some people are reluctant to take a needle to the arm. And even though, you know, I can tell you from personal experience, it's not painful whatsoever. It's less painful than most other vaccines I've had and other kinds of shots. But that said, that's still an issue for some people. And yeah, there are some who are working on vaccines that would just use pills, which would be a real advantage, and hopefully we'll bring some of those more reluctant to take the vaccine on board. And there are all kinds of interesting other approaches. Some government scientists I've talked to are looking to mix and match. So they call it the tricks. I'm thinking about how kids mix and match cereal. Sometimes they look what's in the cupboard and they pick combinations of cereals. And some scientists call it the Cocoa Puffs tricks experiment, where they're saying, hey, maybe we'll take a J&J to start with, and then they bring in the Moderna one, or maybe vice versa, or maybe like BioNTech, and then the switch to the Moderna one. So maybe there's some combination that can we can improve on the efficacy. And it's also important to remember that these aren't 100% effective vaccines. They're quite effective, depending on the variant, you know, 80-90% or even better. But there are always still ways to improve, and that's what they're experimenting on and trying to improve on.
One of the questions, I saw pills and nasal sprays, right? So that it gets kind of exciting on that front. Is that just as effective as a shot you take in the arm? Like I said, a pill, something that dissolves into your body, the nasal spray going through your nose, is that the same as something going in your arm?
There's actually an argument that it could be more effective, especially in terms of the oral formulations. There are all kinds of different nasal spray formulations that are being worked on. I think 7 are actually. And yeah, there's an argument that actually that would be even more effective, because these are respiratory diseases, and maybe the most effective vaccine is one where it's used with a nasal spray as opposed to a shot. It hasn't been proved yet. Interesting technology. We don't want to get too carried away. There are a bunch of companies, not small ones, but these aren't exactly big pharma companies, so a lot of them haven't proven themselves yet. They don't have vaccines or any other kind of therapeutics out in the market, but they are interesting technologies and interesting companies working on them. So the fingers are crossed that either the nasal spray formulations or the others will be effective.
When would we start seeing some results from these clinical trials that are ongoing for some of these new possible vaccines? Even Walter Reed Army Institute of Research, they're looking at maybe making a coronavirus vaccine that would handle different types of coronaviruses, you know, one shot for kind of everything. When can we start seeing some early data on this at least?
I think later this year, we'll start seeing the data and we can start getting excited or less excited when we see that. And we won't really see the new approaches, new formulations, be it nasal or otherwise, till next year. But it's something to look forward to. And as you just suggested, I'm really excited about the idea of one vaccine that can take care of multiple coronaviruses. And that's what there's a gentleman, a doctor at University of Pennsylvania, Drew Weissman, working on that. And there are government and other types of scientists too. And the concern is that this may not be, unfortunately, the last pandemic we see, and we need to be better prepared. So if you have a pan coronavirus vaccine that can handle all kinds of coronaviruses, it's important to remember that we've had every 5-10 years, we've had a new outbreak. It's not always necessarily in the United States, but it's been elsewhere. We had MERS, we had SARS, we have this one, and we are worried about future ones. There's reason to think that there'll be more. These are resulting from the fact that man is encroaching on animals and in terms of where we live, and that'll increasingly happen, and we fly around the world, and that spreads things increasingly. So there's reason to be concerned, and there's reason to work on preparation, and those pan-coronavirus vaccines are a way to do that.
Gregory Zuckerman, special writer at the Wall Street Journal, thank you very much for joining us.
Of course. Great to be here.
In fact, there was a study out a few years ago now, I think it was, that showed a person's recent Google search history was more predictive of suicide than a recent clinician's note.
Joining us now is Dr. Daniel Barron, psychiatrist and author of Reading Our Minds, The Rise of Big Data Psychiatry. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Barron.
Thank you very much for inviting me on.
I wanted to talk about this big data psychiatry notion that you were writing about. The tools to treat patients in the medical field have changed dramatically over the years. You know, lots of new technology that help us out, both in diagnosing and treating patients. But for psychiatry, not so much. Most of the work is still done the way it has been done for a long time, for 100 years, if you want to say. But there is, you know, a lot of tools that are available to kind of make that better, namely our cell phones, the information that that takes from us, speech, facial recognition, these technologies can all help us out in this field of psychiatry. So, Dr. Barron, tell us a little bit more about this.
The psychiatrists have continued. We still talk to our patients and we try to understand as best as we can what's going on in their life. And so today, we haven't developed technology similar to like an EKG or an electrocardiogram, which a cardiologist might use to measure the heart. And primarily one of the reasons why is it's just really hard. We don't really understand what is happening in mental illness in terms of the brain function. And so creating a tool that will measure what's going on in the brain has proven very difficult, if not so far impossible. And so what I'm trying to discuss in my book is a way that we might be able to really dig into the behaviors that we already recognize as being relevant to psychiatry. And we might be able to use technologies that have been developed specifically to measure and trace behavior to then be able to better understand the mental illnesses that we're treating, with the long-term hope of being able to develop tools that approach physiology in the same way that other specialties have developed, this electrocardiogram and tests like that. So things that I look for during an exam, like you were just saying, you know, facial expression, speech processes, all of those things are very relevant to the practice of psychiatry. And right now I'm observing with my brain and my training, which, you know, I've been very fortunate to have some very good training. However, finding tools to measure that and quantify and look for things that are too subtle for my brain to detect, that's what I and a lot of the people I discuss in my book are hoping we can accomplish.
Even just our search and our internet search history, our social media history, these things are pretty invaluable to looking into the current state of somebody's mind. You know, if they'll come to you, you have to ask them the questions. They have to remember, they have to disclose what they do and what they don't want to. But if you have some of this other stuff, you know, you can see for yourself what they've been really looking into, what they've been thinking, really.
There's a lot of really cool work surrounding suicide assessment. Matthew Nock at Harvard University has been doing a lot of really interesting quantitative work using people's search history or using social media to better detect what's going on. In fact, there was a study out a few years ago now, I think it was, that showed a person's recent Google search history was more predictive of suicide than a recent clinician's note. One of the ways I thought about this is people are very honest and very open with Google. Google is open 24/7, and you know, I think of it almost like Uncle Google, right? You can ask Google right. questions that you may not ask your clinician, and you expect Google to tell you a good answer, right? And so people are approaching Google with a lot of this epistemic trust, and being able to partner with that sort of process and be able to create a profile for what a person, what's on their mind and what they're interested in, has proven already to be helpful. I think we've already seen during the pandemic how just doing a review of people searching for things like, I can't smell. Right? So that simple question was very predictive of COVID outbreaks. And so, yeah, being able to use data like that, I think could be very powerful. In addition, there are these other studies, which are really cool also, right? So another thing that I ask patients when they come in is, you know, how's their relationship with their friends or their family? So being able to look at people's social media profiles, see how they refer to themselves to others, seeing if there are changes in the way that they make those references, is also proving to be very useful in early preliminary research studies.
So what's the next step then for psychiatry, at least when it comes to this? How do we get to that next step to be able to use all that data?
The great question is, how do we gather and then use the data? So right now, you know, we see patients in telemedicine visits every day of the week. So we have this wonderful opportunity to be able to record and process that data, to be able to identify these facial expressions, even micro expressions that, you know, we wouldn't consciously recognize. However, right now, because there are no policies or security measures in place for storing that data and processing that data, this enormous resource is going unused and essentially unexplored. And so, you know, sitting in front of a patient in front of a Zoom meeting, it's almost like we've created this amazing Lamborghini of a clinical portal here, and yet we're still, you know, dragging that Lamborghini down the road with a Clydesdale or something. So all of the data that I'm getting from a patient, I am using my brain to be able to understand what's going on, whereas there are all these tools that already exist to measure in a much more quantitative and, in my opinion, useful way, the sort of things that we'd be looking for. And so long term, you know, where I hope this is going and where I believe it is going is we need to have a larger conversation about what the usefulness of this data might be, which is something that the science is going to show us. These are testable questions. But then further, I think we need to have a conversation with patients to be able to really clearly explain which data we think would be helpful, why, and then allow patients to consent to us collecting this data or not.
Dr. Daniel Barron, psychiatrist and author of Reading Our Minds, The Rise of Big Data Psychiatry, thank you very much for joining us.
Hey, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
that's it for today. Join us on social media at Daily Dive Pod on both Twitter and Instagram. Leave us a comment, give us a rating, and tell us the stories that you're interested in. Follow us on iHeartRadio or subscribe wherever you get your podcast. This episode of The Daily Dive is produced by Victor Wright and engineered by Tony Sorrentino. I'm Oscar Ramirez, and this is your Daily Dive.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void. We're prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s. Dance away with hip-hop beats and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.